Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Abaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with the amazing Peter Norvig, Director of Research at Google. Now, Peter, thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Stephen. Thanks.
Now, Peter, you just got an amazing background. Can you share some of your experiences and lessons? And I know it's a little bit unusual, but from the age of four to your professional career in computing.
I'm not sure what goes back all the way to the age of four. There weren't a lot of computers around at that time. But, you know, I think I did have the right background to get me where I am today. So my father was a math professor, and my mother was an English professor. So if you combine the math and the words, that sort of takes you to Google somehow. So not sure exactly how we got here, but here we are today.
Well, you know, can you then, you know, sort of going on from there, share maybe some experiences and lessons from your roles prior to Google?
Let's see. So I've been in a variety of places. You know, I started out as an academic. I was a math major as an undergraduate. When college was over, I couldn't wait to get away. So I worked as a programmer for a couple of years. And then after 2 years, I said, it took me 4 years to get tired of college and only 2 years to get tired of work. Maybe I like school twice as much, and headed out to Berkeley for grad school. Ended up being professor for a number of years. But then over time, I got a little bit frustrated in that kind of the size of a project you could do as an academic, particularly as a young academic, you know, with not much of a track record, was very limited. You know, you can only get a grant or whatever to support a smaller size project. And we didn't have the word big data then, but I kind of intuitively felt that that's what I wanted to do, that I wanted to be able to work on larger projects in terms of more amount of data, more amount of computing power, more amount of people working on the project. And you just couldn't really do that at the time in academia. So I went off into industry, worked at big companies like Sun Microsystems and small companies like startups. I've covered the .edu and .com for a while, even the .gov top-level domain, running the computer science division at NASA. And I guess the idea was always to find an interesting project and find a good group of people to work with. And beyond that, a lot of freedom to consider different types of possibilities.
You know, you've had this really rich history. Do you have any sort of lessons that you can share from those experiences? For example, at NASA, something that sort of carries you today, or if you were talking to people, you would say, you know what, these are some really great points I learned while I was at NASA, and I share them because I think it'll help you in your career.
So I think that was really a different experience for me. So one definitely is different working for the government, where the goal is really to be a good steward of the taxpayers' money more than it is to be effective in quickly solving your problems. And at NASA, I think in some ways it was similar to a role as a teacher, in that a lot of what it was communication. So I had a team at NASA Ames that was doing great work, some people who were, you know, really at the top of the field in autonomous robotic planning and other areas like that, and in human-computer interaction. I don't know if I had that much to contribute to their work. I think they would have done great work no matter what. But I think my role there was mostly around trying to communicate what their work was to the rest of NASA. And, you know, to the rest of NASA, computer science is a sideline. Their job is to get rockets up, get people back safely, so they're more mechanical engineers and not computer scientists, and a little bit, careful to use new technology because its stakes are so high for these missions. And so my job was to convince them what the technology could do, to be able to explain it, and that we were 100% behind it, that this wasn't just some research project, that this was something that we were going to work with the missions to make sure that it was going to do a good job.
You know, a considerable number of people in the audience are senior executives. In fact, this goes out through IDGIT World. And when I met my senior executives, they're CTOs or CIOs of major corporations and enterprises. And right now, innovation colonies and agility, those are sort of key issues. You know, you've got this background with startups. Do you see any sort of lessons from your startup backgrounds that you can sort of pass on to enterprises that are trying to innovate in their environment?
I guess the way to do innovation is to have good ideas and nurture them. And it's a process of putting together the teams who can get something done with the problem areas. And innovation, I think, is trying to do that in a unique way. So I focused on computer science, and I think we've had some great opportunities where industries have been disrupted and where there's been new ideas. And so innovation is the right thing to do. And that may not always be the case, that the right way to solve a problem is to innovate. It might be that the way you're doing things now is just fine. And it's not that you should innovate for innovation's sake. You should look carefully at what the right way to approach a problem is. And to me, I think the key has always been a close partnership. So it doesn't seem to work if you say, we're going to have a team of researchers who are in a separate location, and they come up with an idea, and then they pass the idea on to the teams who have to implement it, where there's sort of a two-class structure. It's got to be one team working together where, you shouldn't care or sometimes even know whose title is what. Are you a researcher or an engineer or who are you? It should feel more like here's everybody working together as part of a team, and they're all bringing what they know, and some of that is in the new area, some of it is in the existing area. But everybody's goal is to solve the problem rather than to show off the innovation.
You know, what you describe, I can see that sort of pervasive within your Google, I guess, Alphabet environment. Can you talk about how you got into Google? And then once you got into Google, what were your past research interests at Google? And how does that continue to shape Google today and into the future and even the world?
Yeah, So I joined Google in 2001. So the company started in 98. In 2001, there were 200 people. I was a little bit worried that maybe I was too late and they had already done all the interesting stuff. But fortunately, they left a few things. And the company, of course, has been growing ever since. I guess I got into it for a couple of reasons. One, it was a good time to make a move. So I had been at NASA for 3 years. The government bureaucracy was getting a little heavy on me, and there was a time of transition for NASA in that a new head of NASA was coming in. So I felt like, for the next year, it's just going to be adjusting to the new person. So this would be a good time, if you're going to make a change, to make the change. And so I looked around and said, what would be the best place to go to from here? And I had known about Google for a while, had run into a couple of the people in various roles. And it just seemed like that was the best place to be. I was interested in this idea of doing more with data, and Google were the ones who had it. And I worked on language understanding somewhat since my undergraduate days and for my PhD thesis, and felt like Google was the one that was doing the most with processing words, not at the deepest level of parsing sentences as I had been used to, more at the level of understanding keywords, but seemed like that was the thing that was most aligned with what I wanted to do. And the idea that in general that Google was going to have to be kind of a machine learning company, that its forte was processing a lot of data, and doing that, there's definitely a kind of systems component of how do you build the large distributed computer systems to be able to handle that level of data. But there was also a machine learning component of how do you make sense of that data. And it seemed like it was right for Google to start focusing on that area. And so it was the right time, both for me and for them, to get together.
You know, it's a kind of a fascinating journey. And, you know, everybody's been watching the news with AlphaGo and that sort of 4-1 win over Lee Sedol on the sort of the Go game. And DeepMind, do you interface with the DeepMind people that much, or Jeff Dean?
So there's kind of two separate things. So DeepMind is a company we acquired. They're in London now. So they work pretty autonomously. I'm in contact and talk with them. Always look forward when some of them come to visit us. But on a day-to-day basis, they're pretty much on their own, and they did a fantastic job. Then within Google, we have a team looking at these neural net technologies. And as you mentioned, Jeff Dean, a prominent member of that team, Jeff Hinton, one of the other members, and many others as well, contributing a lot. And those are the ones that I work more closely with on a day-to-day basis.
Well, we have machine learning and deep learning integrated into everything that Google is doing. And, of course, we have the release of TensorFlow. Now, Peter, what about your hybrid research interests at Google today and into the future? And what does this mean to better enable business and education in the broader community?
So I have a couple of main interests right now. One is around education. And so we worked on making tools for online education, for people to be able to put together courses. So I'm interested in that, both from the point of view of internally, how do we educate our Google engineers, how do we educate Google users about how to use our products, and then also once we have to build these systems for those needs, once we built them, we might as well open source them and allow the world to use them as well. And once you do that, your users come back with more requests for more features and so on. So I've been working on that. And then my second area is around the deep learning, and that's and it's also, I guess, in some ways, kind of an educational effort of making it easier for engineers within Google to apply these machine learning techniques that we have. So right now, as you say, we've got all these systems we use internally, and if you're a PhD expert in the field, you can get a lot done. But if you're not, if you're an engineer with other expertise, then these tools are not quite as accessible. And so trying to bring them to the level where they're more pervasive and can be used by everyone more easily. And if we can do that within Google, then maybe someday we can open source that as well and get that out to the rest of the world.
You see controversy around machine learning, deep learning, and statements from people like Elon and others. What are your views on this?
I think that machine learning and AI in general are tools that we build these systems and we control them, and they've proven to be very valuable so far. I think any technology has the possibility of having unintended consequences. And, you know, some people like to think of these Terminator-like scenarios. I don't really think of it that way. You know, I think what I'm more maybe a little concerned about is the unintended consequences. And so, you know, think of things like automobiles, which were very useful technology, helped humanity in many ways, but also have some consequences like pollution and overcrowding in cities and so on that we didn't anticipate. And so I think it's great that people are looking at ways to use the technology more wisely, to think about possibly some of the ways you can go wrong. And if we think about that ahead of time, then we'll probably end up in a wiser use of the technology. So I'm glad that people are focusing on making it safer, making it better for everybody all around.
Peter, it's just fascinating what's happening. Now, from your perspective, what are some of the outlier ideas, research, and kinds of startups that could disrupt three or more domains of your choosing 10 to 20 years into the future? And I'm thinking areas such as like fintech or biotech, AI, and so on.
It's hard to predict, especially the future. I guess one of the areas that's most fascinating to me is around biotech and health. It certainly seems like there's a lot going on there. Google or Alphabet's involved in some of that. I see a lot of the other startups in the area. I mean, it's just so fundamental. If you don't have your health, what do you have? And so, you know, it's something that touches everybody and something where it looks like we're just starting to get the tools to have a much better understanding and many opportunities to improve so much. So, you know, it's beyond my level of expertise. I never took biology in college, I'm fascinated by what's happening and looking for things to happen there. I think robotics is a great area. You know, it feels like we're on the curve of adoption for robotics. We are now where we were with PCs in, you know, maybe the late 70s or early 1980s, where if you remember back then, you know, you could buy a computer, maybe in kit form or maybe fully assembled, and you could sort of run a little game or maybe a spreadsheet on it, but you couldn't really do very much that was useful. It was more an entertainment or just to have a cool technological toy. But then within a decade, everybody had a computer and everybody had a good use for it. And so I think in that kind of time frame, that's going to happen with robotics. They'll probably be first in increased factory use. There certainly are robots in factories today, but we're going to see more and more of that. And then over time, in the home as well. So those are areas that I'm looking at. But it just seems so exciting that it's so easy now to push a new technology along. That it's you know, you can start a company without a lot of capitalization. There are a lot of areas that involve software and not having to build a hardware product, and those are easier to get started. So I think we're in for an area of a lot of innovation and a lot of integration of the technologies that go into our life.
It's interesting. Some are suggesting two lines of rapid development. One is in sort of biology with CRISPR-Cas9 and genetic editing, and the other is with regards to machines and machine learning and deep learning. Some even suggested perhaps thinking it almost like a metaphor for evolution. What do you see here?
Well, I mean, I think talking of those as evolution is more of a metaphor than biology, right? So, you know, machine learning is not an evolutionary force because it doesn't deal with biological life. So, to think of it as as evolution is a metaphor, and maybe that's a good way to think about things. But I just think of it as a tool that's going to help us, and we'll be in for change. But it's it's a very different type of change.
Do you have some additional views on CRISPR-Cas9, that is genetic gene editing?
It's not my area. It just seems like a great tool. It seems like we'll have a lot more ability to address certain diseases. We'll get a lot more understanding of how the biological world works. And so I know people are very, very excited about the applications, but it's not my area to be able to predict exactly where it's all going to go.
I've had discussions with Tom Mitchell, Andrew Ng, Judeo Pearl, and others in the AI space. So what do you think about Judeo Pearl's work?
So, he's a real hero for me. I think he's the one that's probably most responsible for getting AI to where it is today, in that we changed from when I was in graduate school in the early 80s to where we are today, and I think Pearl was a big part of it. So when I started, when you thought of AI, the kind of canonical example of AI was an expert system. And so what did that mean? It meant you went out and interviewed an expert and says, how do you do this task, whatever it is we're trying to do? And the expert said, when I'm in this situation, I tend to do that. And so you by hand wrote out rules that the expert thought were the right rules for the domain, and you wrote them using largely a logical notation. So if this is true, then that is true. And Pearl changed all that. So the first thing he said was that logic is very limited. Sure, if you're going to play chess, then you can talk about logic, because everything in a chess board, is literally black and white, and logic is good for situations where everything is true or false. But in almost everything in the real world, there's this fog of confusion, and we don't have only true and false. We have lots of uncertainty. And Pearl said, let's embrace that uncertainty rather than try to dance around the edges. Let's try to address it full on. And the technology to do that is probability rather than logic. And people had shied away from probability because they thought, it's just numbers. It's not real thinking or real intelligence. And there's going to be too many numbers to keep track of. And what Pearl did was show, if there's any structure to the domain, then you don't need all the numbers. You only need a limited number of numbers. And in fact, we can handle them. And then the second thing that happened was to say, okay, now we've made the shift from logic to probability. Pearl provided the technology to make that efficient. So that was a great change. And then the second change was, say, now let's move away from writing down all these rules by hand, by introspecting on our own thinking process. And instead, let's have machine learning techniques that'll learn the parameters for these probabilistic networks. And so that shift from logic to probability and from handwritten to learned is the two hallmarks of where we are in AI today. And if you had to pick one person who was most responsible, I would go with Pearl as being the one that helped kickstart us along that road.
Judea has this work on kind of codifying or providing a mathematical modeling causality. Do you have views on this?
Yeah. So, if you look at the field of statistics, they often get stuck of saying, we can easily come up with a correlation, say these two things are correlated with each other, but it's harder to come up with causation. If A and B are correlated, did A cause B, did B cause A, or is there some other C that causes both of them? And in the kind of raw statistics, they say, that's not a question you can answer. But Pearl didn't like that answer, and he wanted to come up with ways in which you can answer it. I don't think it's been 100% successful yet, but I think he's made good progress, and he's certainly shown some ways in which you can make that distinction. And it's certainly an important one if you want to not just observe and describe the world, but if you want to go forward and make decisions, then you have to understand this causal structure as well as the correlational structure.
You have Pedro Domingos trying to unify the five schools of machine learning through a master algorithm. What are your views on this?
So I definitely like his book. I think he's done one of the better jobs of bringing machine learning to a wider audience, a non-expert audience. So his book kind of covers the whole field. He looks at all these different historical sort of camps of ways of looking at machine learning, and he describes each one in a way that's good for a reader who has a level of sophistication and is willing to put in some work to read the book. You know, it's not like reading a novel, but it's not like reading a textbook either. It's kind of halfway in between, and so I think he really hit the sweet spot there in trying to describe it. If it were me, I probably wouldn't put as much emphasis on trying to combine them all. So he's saying he's looking for this master algorithm, the one algorithm that will do everything. I guess I feel more comfortable saying I'm willing to have a toolbox. You know, so I don't need the one super powerful Swiss Army knife that does everything. I'd be willing to have a toolbox with five separate tools in it, and maybe have to think a little bit about which tool you want to use for which job. So I think that's just a question of style. But he's certainly done a good job in explaining the individual approaches and in explaining the importance of machine learning throughout all sorts of different industries.
I guess the key exciting area is that Google is trying to produce these tools that could be readily used. And this is of high interest and a real priority in the enterprise space to have these kinds of tools.
So it's interesting. It's a little bit tricky to get these things out there in that it's always easier to take what you know and apply it to one specific domain than it is to make a general purpose tool that's good for everybody. And so we find internally in a lot of our projects, you end up re-implementing a lot of stuff just because, there's 100 decisions you have to make. And if you have a level of expertise in machine learning and in software development, and it's probably easier to make those 100 decisions from scratch rather than try to fit them into a general purpose tool. But if you don't have that expertise, then you certainly need something to guide you along the way. And we and many others are looking into how to make that easier.
Peter, can you discuss your life outside of Google and maybe some of your interests that are your passions?
Let's see. My two main hobbies would be photography and bicycling. So those are passions for me. And then, I got my family, my wife, my kids are now off to college, so see them a little bit less. So it's just me, my wife, and the dogs at home now. And then I get a chance to travel quite a bit. And so see some parts of the world. And so that's been exciting as well.
Peter, we're down to our last one or two questions. You've traveled the world, you've done a lot of speaking and so on. Do you have any interesting stories to share? Maybe something unexpected, amazing, or amusing? Perhaps even surprising?
Well, let's see. So let's go back to, you asked me from when I was 4 years old, and I don't have any stories from then. But when I was fresh out of college, so I was working as a programmer, And they would send me off to travel, to visit customer sites and so on. And it really struck me then that, it seemed like, hey, you know, the world might be changing a little bit, because I'd be in the airport and 90% of the people there were these, businessmen with their briefcases, you know. So really it did look like Mad Men in those days. And it was very, sort of stereotypical. And then on each plane, there'd be a couple of us kind of scruffy younger people with backpacks rather than briefcases. And as you look at them, it turns out they're always carrying a computer magazine or something like that. So it seemed like the world was starting to split back then. That was, I guess, 1978, that there was these traditional businessmen, and it was mostly men. And then there were these computer nerds that were somehow sneaking into this world. And I thought then, you know, I bet something's going to happen with this. And I guess I was right.
Ah, so you knew. How about your future?
Well, you know, so at Google, we haven't got to the end of the internet yet. So there's still plenty of things to do. I'm excited about the projects I'm working on now. It's also, you know, I had this previous career as an academic, and back in 95, wrote a textbook with my co-author Stuart Russell from Berkeley. And every 7 or so years, it's time to write a revision. It turns out that right now is the time to write a revision. So that's another project I'm involved with now. I'm really happy that it turned out that this year is the year to work on it, and not like 3 years ago, because if it'd been 3 years ago, we would have written it, and then we would have had to start all over again and put in all this new deep learning work. Now is a great time to put that work in for a new edition. So I'm keeping busy. There's plenty of stuff left to do.
Peter, you have a storied career, and you're a giant in the industry who continues to shape the world with your many significant historical contributions. I know your schedule is demanding, and we're very fortunate to have you come in to do this interview today. And thank you for sharing so many of your deep experiences with our audience, and especially from an icon in the industry.
Thanks, Stephen. Pleasure to talk with you.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Peter Norvig, Director of Research, Google Incorporated.